Welcome to the Libertarian Podcast from the Hoover Institution. I'm your host, Troy Senek, and the Libertarian is Professor Richard Epstein, the Peter and Kirsten Bedford Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, the Lawrence A. Tisch Professor of Law at NYU, and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, law and policy, Biden style. And Richard, since we last spoke, Bernie Sanders has officially dropped out of the presidential race, thrown his endorsement to Joe Biden. And so Joe Biden is now the de facto nominee of the Democratic Party for president. So thought we'd take this opportunity to take a look at where he stands on some of the issues near and dear to your heart. And I want to start with one that's a little personal, and that's the focus of your most recent column for Defining Ideas. In 1991, when Joe Biden was the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee during the confirmation hearings for Clarence Thomas's Supreme Court nomination, he, in a fashion that will be familiar for those who remember the Robert Bork ordeal, tried to tarnish Justice Thomas by associating him with radicals. And one of the radicals he chose was no less than our own Richard Epstein. He waved a copy of your book, Takings, in front of Justice Thomas and asked him if he agreed with any of the principles therein in a kind of sort of quasi-McCarthy-esque moment. I would commend people to your DI column for your full explanation of this, but for our purposes here, can you just give us the précis of the Takings book and why it was so inflammatory to a figure like Joe Biden?
Well, the 1980s were a period of strong property rights, and people were very worried that the Reagan administration would make some kind of a revolution on that issue. The dominant academic thinking with respect to the Takings Clause and the Due Process Clause and the Contracts Clause, all dealing with either private property or with economic liberties, was in these particular areas, if the federal government wants to take over, it can do so. It has no jurisdictional limitations, and the protections that you give to individual owners of property would only apply to those cases in which they literally went into the land and sat on it and threw you off. But the full range of regulatory schemes that restrict the use in one form or another, that are comprehensive in general, these are all per se legal. And what I did is I looked at this stuff and I said, I don't agree with it at all. And so I formulated a list of four questions based on the Takings Clause in an effort to really tighten this thing up. Is private property been taken? How do you explicate that? Is it for a public use? How do you explicate that? Is there a police power justification for it so that you can shut people down without paying them? And if you don't have that, have you given a form of compensation in cash or in kind? It looks like a very innocent objective, but it turns out they're kind of matched pairs. I have a very broad definition of private property consistent with the common law, which is that it includes not only outright ownership of land or any chattel, but all the partial interests that are in it, leases, mortgages, and stuff like that. With the public use, they have a very capacious reading saying, if the public wants it, it's a public use. I tended to say, no, you either have to have the public use it, or it has to be a situation in which it's going to be open access, or it has to be a situation in which you're controlling various holdout problems that could arise in the private administrative land. And when it comes to the police power, I said, by and large, you have to be stopping some kind of a tort. And the modern view is the police power is pretty much whatever you want to do. If you think prices are too high, you could lower them under the police power. If you think they're too low, you could raise them under the police power. No problem. And then when it comes to compensation, their attitude was, if it's a general form of regulation, you're always compromised or always compensated because you're living in a good society. And if it's a particular case, we could always undercompensate you by denying you, for example, anything for your subjective value in the land, for the moving costs, for your lost goods that you can't sell somewhere else. So it was a complete retake of this whole thing. And it provoked an incredible reaction in the academic community. People were just incredulous. When the book was first sent up to the Harvard Press for review, the initial editor said, Richard has lost his mind. So Senator Biden was not alone. The book, you know, still survives. I don't think it's ever been adequately refuted, although it's been multiply denounced. And so he thought this was a great way to get after an academic, to get after Reagan, to get after the property rights movement, and to try to put Thomas on the spot. And I understood why he was doing that. And so two things happened. One is that Thomas decides to parry the situation, and he does make the remarkable assertion, well, private property is in the Constitution, and it's protected by a constitutional amendment, full stop. And frankly, I said to myself, I'm so glad he did that. Why does he have to fight my battles when he's up for a nomination, which has enough other problems? And then, although I didn't put it in there, Biden, through one of his assistants, said, would you like to come to testify? And I said no. And one of the wisest decisions I ever made, because I don't want to be there being pilloried by a senator when I'm not allowed to speak. I said, if the senator would ever like to debate this, I'm happy to do it on some neutral forum. I never got an answer to that question. I don't think I get an answer to it then. So that was the kind of atmospherics of the case. The technical stuff, which I talk about in the column, explain in the context of the situation of landmark preservation ordinances just how different the results are in the two systems. The bottom line is, in my view, if you want air rights, you have to pay for them. And if you look at the court, they said if you want air rights, you just have to want them very much, and they're yours free of charge, pretty much so.
All right. So that's the Joe Biden of 1991. I want to talk a little bit about the Joe Biden of 2020, and I'll turn to some of the policy proposals his campaign is touting. Let me start you with energy and the environment. One of Biden's proposals is to, this is a quote from his policy platform, achieve a 100% clean energy economy and net zero emissions by 2050. Two distinct but related questions here, Richard. One, is that desirable? Two, is it possible?
Well, I mean, I think the first question you have to ask is it possible? And it turns out, I think by any decent account, the answer is no. What we do know about energy is that fossil fuels have the following enormous advantage. They're very compact and they're very powerful, so that you can put within a barrel more stuff from fossil fuels than you could put in a huge warehouse trying to do solar panels or wind. Also, it's storable, and the other stuff, either you have to use it or you lose it. And with wind, for example, and with sun, sometimes you get so much of it that it becomes a bad rather than a good, and you have to get rid of it. So if you're trying to run an economy on this stuff, it's going to be so erratic, so up and down. It may work in some places like sun in Arizona, but it's not going to be sun in Germany. And it turns out the technological limitations are absolutely overpowering. Mark Mills of the Manhattan Institute has written about this time after time after time. These are not technical improvements. They're absolute physical limitations on how much you can wrench out of this stuff. It's not going to happen. And then the question is, why do you want to do this? This is the battle between the climate alarmists on the one hand and the climate deniers on the other. And one should wince when you hear both of these titles, because it means that nobody's trying to get this right. But the bottom lines of this are just a couple of points. One is that carbon dioxide has pluses as well as minuses. It is something which is extremely important with respect to photosynthesis, and that increases the fertility and the greenness with respect to the planet on Earth. And a higher green content on the Earth means greater temperature stability, even if it means a slight rise with respect to the temperature minimum. So its photosynthesis is important, and this is not a small effect. Basically, the increase in land coverage in the last 30-odd years is about the size of North and South America combined. Deserts are shrinking, and all sorts of other things are happening like that. And when you start saying you want to stop carbon dioxide, do you want to reverse that particular trend? The other thing is you try to look to some leading indicators that are going to show you that, you know, there's some really major stuff that is afoot. And one of the things you could start to do is to look to land prices to see if they're going to impound some real future scarcity. And it turns out they do not. Agricultural production has gotten at an all-time high, and our sophistication with respect to seeds means that right now, and this is one very nice article I read, whether you start in northern Mississippi or go up to southern Minnesota, where the temperature gradients are about 20 degrees, it turns out you could get the right kind of seed in both areas and have extremely high yields. And our yields now are higher than they've ever been, so that what's happening is the total amount of farmland that we need now is actually under reduction. So I don't quite see what the peril is in this particular situation. And the third point I'd want to make is, if you do these analyses, the tendency is to say, look at the wind, it's wonderful. Look at the sun, it's wonderful. But you have to do these things from birth to death. You have to figure out, well, how are you going to fund this wind terminal? What are you going to build? What kinds of pipes you need? How are you going to dispose of this stuff? And the same thing with respect to this. So, you know, one of the things that the environmentalists like to say is you want to put a little walkway over a little bridge on your land. That's a form of temporary temperature alteration, which is thermal approval, thermal pollution, you got to get a permit from it. Now you want to cover hundreds of acres with these kind of reflecting things, that's exempt from the law. And so it turns out that if you apply an even sort of situation so that every form of emission from every kind of abuse is covered, it turns out I don't think that you could make either solar or wind energy work. And I regard this as completely naive. The correct rule is you get the right taxes on the various kinds of inputs. And if solar and wind energy can pay their way, then they will use it. But you don't want to subject them to artificial penalties. You don't want to give them artificial subsidies. And the same thing is true with respect to the fossil fuels that we have. So, for example, to see a disastrous situation, look at Andrew Cuomo in New York, where there are massive shortages going on. On the alternative, if you start looking in Pennsylvania where they allow fracking, it has not produced the kind of massive dislocation. There are always economic risks, as, for example, when we have the coronavirus-type situation. But it seems to me that the current energy policies are vastly superior to anything that Senator Biden wants to have. Indeed, I think his policies are quite likely to prove disastrous.
One of the issues that was a flashpoint back in the primaries, although in the present environment that seems like a million years ago, when Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren were pushing Medicare for All, Joe Biden was planting his flag on the public option, which some of our listeners may remember from back in the days when we were fighting over what was going to be in the Obamacare legislation. And Richard, to hear its defenders tell the story, you don't have to be worried about big government when it comes to a public option. This is simply one option amongst many others. If you like private health insurance, you can have private health insurance. But there's also this option provided by the government that's there if you want it. And if you don't worry about it. Nice, voluntary, centrist solution. Is that the right way to think about it?
No. What happens is just think about the situation with respect to TVA, a much more innocuous program. And what you did is you say, well, we're going to put in a government power source and we're going to have all these private things and they can compete happily with one another. But there are two things about them, which means that you don't get a market of equivalence. One of them is you put this public option in, there are going to be enormous public subsidies that are going to go to the particular option, which are not going to be given to its private competitors. And these things could take place in so many different forms because there are so many joint costs and so many committees that are going to be involved that you can do for this what you can do for Medicare and Medicaid, which is to take a huge fraction of these costs and take them off of the small budget and put them on the budget of some other organization with which they do business, have transfer pricing scams of one kind or another. So you get subsidies. And secondly, the government, which is doing this, is also going to regulate these guys on the other side. And what it can do is now impose costs upon them that they could exempt the government service from. And so by the time you're done with this, you're going to have a huge penalty on the private sector, and you're going to have a huge subsidy on this, and then you say the two of these things are going to be able to compete. So in the end, all the private plans will start to go out. So the basic rule in any kind of a market is you never let the government take two positions, that of a regulator on the one hand and a market provider on the other. And that's exactly what you're doing in this situation. In the end, what will happen is the private companies will start to fail. There'll be no bailout with respect to them. People will start moving into the public situation. And then you will just have a public option, and it will be a monopoly carrier, and it will be completely unresponsive. And if you think these guys know how to run the post office, then you ought to be in favor of that. But I tend to prefer getting my mail served by UPS, Federal Express, or any one of another dozen columnists. So what you really need to do is the exact opposite. Figure out all of the restrictions that are in the Obamacare legislation, all the restrictions on other things, and remove them. To give you but one illustration, for years there have been inexcusable restrictions on the ability of individuals to perfect telemedicine. And so when I went to Kansas at the very time that Biden had his hearing with Thomas, the big issue to these guys was, how do you help somebody on the farm if it turns out there's no doctor nearby? Can we get telemedicine? And telemedicine across state lines is an absolute natural. It's been banned forever. And now in the midst of this CV thing with the coronavirus, the restrictions have been lifted. They ought to be made permanent. So the correct solution is the exact opposite. You don't want to have more government in this thing. You want to get rid of every unsensible restriction on the operation of competitive markets, because they can do one thing that no government plan can do. They can improve efficiency, They can lower costs and they can improve access. The government programs always end up having huge subsidies and kind of disappointing results because they don't know how to calibrate their benefits, which is surely the case with respect to the ACA, the Obamacare plan today.
The last thing that I'll ask you, another quote from Biden's own platform, where he writes, currently more than half of all states have in place so-called right-to-work laws, which in fact deprive workers of their rights. These laws exist only to deprive unions of the financial support they need to fight for higher wages and better benefits. As president, Biden will repeal the Taft-Hartley provisions that allow states to impose right-to-work laws. So, Richard, there's the nationalization of the policy there. But before we get to that, respond to that characterization. Do these laws exist only to deprive unions of financial support?
Well, they exist to deprive unions of financial support, but they don't exist to deprive workers of their freedom and their options. The reason why right-to-work laws essentially have been successful is the reason why unions have been failures. The situation has been the same with respect to right-to-law laws and options since 1947. The peak of labor representation in the United States was at 35% or so in 1954. It's around 6% today. Why do you lose all that stuff? Because unions do not represent workers in a sensible way. And if you start to figure out what's going on, first of all, they've got no monopoly power to exploit because markets have become much more competitive both domestically and internationally. So unions spend most of their time doing what I regard as terrible things, trying to keep out non-union businesses with local zoning laws and trying to keep out foreign products. And in each of these cases, they line up with the internal producers of their goods, so employer and employees get together in a protectionist program. It turns out unions have incredible internal conflicts. Older workers are willing to make sure that the new people get very, very low wages, so they get very high pensions, and the whole system turns out to be completely dysfunctional. The Janus decision, which is constitutional, is an illustration of the fact that the most difficult thing that a worker has today is that they want to opt out of a union. It turns out they're very, very difficult to do so. So what happens is the unions are a losing intellectual structure. They're bad in the private sector. They're bad in the public sector. When they start getting higher wages, they get them for a very short period of time, and then they tend to go belly up. So if you want to figure out whether you're a worker and you want to join an automobile union, you could join the UAW. You'll get an increase in wages and your business will start to turn south. Or you could stay out of it and you could get lower wages, which are much more sustainable in the long run, and you can grow with the success of your employer. Unions make money only by making employers miserable. And the only way in which you're going to get productivity in the workforce is to have them cooperate, and that's what takes a competitive market. Joe Biden is 100% wrong on this mystical view that he takes with respect to union. It's part of his general intellectual framework. I'm a classical liberal. He is certainly not. I think everything in his platform is wrong from top to bottom.
You've been listening to the Libertarian Podcast with Richard Epstein. Remember, you can read Richard's column, The Libertarian, at Defining Ideas at hoover.org, and you can follow him on Twitter at Richard A. Epstein. And if you enjoy the show, please rate it on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. For Richard Epstein, I'm Troy Sinek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution, where we advance ideas that define a free society. For more information about our work and to hear more of our podcasts or see our video content, please visit hoover.org.